Previously on Colors.
A black man and his family went to Texas to a cemetery to look for their ancestors.
When we got there, we discovered this pristine, beautiful cemetery, but none of our family members were in it until my sister recognized that there was this lightly driven path along the side of the cemetery. And so we started walking that path that led into the woods, and that's when we realized we were at a whites-only cemetery. Hickory Grove had a section in the woods for the black people.
John Mills found his ancestors, and since that time, more than 20 years ago, he's been helping people all over the world find their roots.
Coming up in this episode of Colors.
Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis on the witness stand.
She, I think, started out much more outraged than she sort of ended up.
Washington Post senior critic at large Robin Givhan writing about the powerful black woman in Georgia that's overseeing the sprawling election tampering case against former President Donald Trump, somehow ending up on the witness stand talking about an affair that she had with the special prosecutor in the case.
I mean, I think it seemed that along the way, she took a deep breath and let some of that steam go. But I was really struck by the way that, in many ways, that fury seemed to be so focused and so precise.
That's coming up in this episode of Colors.
Simmering racial tensions.
Segregation now and tomorrow and forever.
Fighting. Injustice.
I have a dream.
Conflict looming.
Justice! Peace!
Brutality exposed.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
The search for solutions starts here.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C., this is Colors, a dialogue on race in America.
A little more than a week ago, Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie T. Willis walked into the Georgia courtroom where lawyers were arguing over whether she would have to take the stand. It was the back half of the long day's hearing on whether Willis should be removed from the sprawling election tampering case her office has brought against former President Donald Trump and his associates. But the debate between the dueling teams of lawyers became moot when Willis announced that she wanted to testify. Willis settled into the high-back witness chair, and then she loosed her fury. Those are not my words. Those are the words of Robin Givhan. She's a senior critic at large for the Washington Post, and she wrote a piece called, "When Fonnie Willis Took the Stand, Her Fury Was Precise and Laser-Focused." Robin joins us on this podcast, this episode, to talk about her observations and her thoughts watching this all unfold. Robin, true to form, you've written another thought-provoking piece for the Washington Post, and there are a number of elements about this that I want to talk about, but in the context of what we do here at Colors, which is about race and racial themes and issues in the U.S. Fonnie Willis, for those who don't know, and I'm sure there are very few people, is a black woman, a powerful district attorney in Fulton County, Georgia. Can you talk to me about your impression of her and her presence and her appearance on this stage?
Yeah, I mean, I had seen her speak before, and she is, she has in the past come off as a very impressive, confident person, and it was interesting to see her during this hearing in Fulton County because, in the midst of all these lawyers sort of going back and forth about should she testify, did she have to testify, she walked in to the courtroom a little bit breathless because she had rushed over and announced that she, in fact, was going to take the stand and she was eager to take the stand. And when she did so, it was evident that she was not pleased with the situation.
So, yeah, no, that was really clear, because she definitely made sure people knew that she was not happy about her personal life being injected into this situation. And also, you wrote about this as well. She talked about how she was not on trial. It was the other people that were on trial. Part of what took place during this event was the details of an affair that she had with her special prosecutor, with the special prosecutor, Nathan Wade, came to light. And I'm interested in hearing what your thoughts are about how she handled herself versus how he did, and in the context of what you thought about when you wrote your piece.
Well, he testified first, and I was struck by how meticulous it seemed that he was trying to be, and how even keeled he was trying to be. But I found a lot of imprecision in his testimony. And, you know, there's no jury, I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, just sort of listening to it, I found that when he would begin a sentence with, "So the thing is," and then he would get to the end of that sentence, and there wouldn't really be anything that was there. There was never any real clear conclusion. And one of the things that, two things that they were really drilling him on was, when their romantic relationship started. Did it start before he was appointed special prosecutor? And also, did he use essentially money that he was being paid as special prosecutor to then take Fani Willis on cruises and vacations and other things? And on the subject of these vacations, he said that she paid him back, that they split the expenses, but no, he didn't have all of these receipts because she paid him back in cash. And this cash transaction, these multiple cash transactions, really seemed to stymie the defense lawyers, who couldn't understand or couldn't believe that these two people were exchanging large sums of cash like that in, you know, this era of electronic commerce.
Yeah. And in reading your piece, it appeared as though he struggled. And you said what he said, you said what you wrote, and that he kept saying, "Here's the thing," but there was no thing. And when it came to Fani Willis, District Attorney Fani Willis telling her side of the story, things came off a little differently, or a lot differently, in your opinion, correct?
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things I want to say is that in, you know, that headline, and in thinking about how to characterize her outrage, her fury, you know, my editor and I were very careful about not characterizing her as, you know, this sort of cliche, this trope of the angry Black woman. You know, she was someone who came in and she was angry, but it was very clearly aimed at specific things that lawyers had said. She didn't, it was interesting that she never actually looked angry. You know, it was all in the tone of her voice. It was in some of her gestures, and it was in some of the answers that she gave. But the way in which she described the cash transactions, you know, she talked about it in the context of her father, in the context of being a single woman, in the context of dating, and this idea that, you know, cash, as they say, is king. It can get you out of a jam when everything else sort of goes awry. And it made a lot more sense when she was talking about it. And I felt like a lot of that fury focused her answers and focused our attention on a really complicated, nuanced backstory about why such a large percentage of Black people, Hispanic people, still engage in cash transactions rather than credit or electronic transactions.
That's specifically what I wanted to drill down a little bit with you on, that fact that, you know, there's a reason for that. Could you elaborate a little bit about what you think it is?
Well, you know, I think some of it is, you know, a distrust of financial institutions and banks. And a lot of that stems from the fact that, you know, it's more difficult, more challenging for people of color to get credit. And I think there's also for a certain generation of Black Americans, and I kind of put my father in this category, there was this, sometimes their credit wasn't accepted. A check wasn't accepted. That the only thing that would be accepted, you know, was cash. That the only color that they could, you know, present to the world that wouldn't be judged would be the color of green money. And I think a lot of that, you know, sort of still lingers. You know, I said to someone that, you know, my dad recently passed away, and a very good friend of mine who had gone through the same thing said to me, you know, when you're cleaning out, you know, the house, don't just, you know, throw away boxes and, you know, clothes and things without going through them, because you'll find cash. You need to be careful. And he was right.
You're absolutely right about going through things, going through boxes. My father passed in 2017, and I'm very sorry about your father, and our sincere condolences to you. But you're absolutely right. You know, I found some treasures. I didn't find any money, but I found some little notes, though, in pockets and little books and things. So, you know, I grew up in the era, you know, when, yeah, cash was more readily available to our family. Credit cards were not, and credit wasn't as available. How do you think now, and I don't want to get too far away from your story here, what you're talking about, how do you think what Fannie Willis said impacts people who heard her, especially younger people, and what can they do with what they learned, what they heard?
Well, you know, I think it was striking that someone who is in her position and with her pedigree, you know, still adhere to the advice that she'd been given by her father and still believed that there was something more secure and something that was, just something just more secure about having cash available. And I don't think it's necessarily, you know, sort of paranoia or anything like that. But, you know, there are plenty of people who think, oh, the banking system will get hacked and I'll still be able to, you know, get out of town. But I also felt that in her describing the advice that she'd been given, it was, you know, a reminder of, you know, how the distance that she had come, just, you know, measured against, say, her parents. And certainly the distance that she has come measured against her grandparents. But at the same time, a recognition that for all that distance, it's still not that far.
Robin, aside from just the pleasure of being able to read the writing that you did on this story, which, you know, it's a very serious situation. I mean, but, you know, the way in which you framed it, the way in which you wrote about it, you know, there are elements of the story that make us think about other things that have nothing to do with what's at stake here. And in this case, I'm just wondering, how did Fannie Willis come out of this situation as a professional, as a Black woman, as a relatively, I guess, young person on the national stage? In this situation, how did she come out of this?
Well, I don't know how, the judge is going to decide in this case, but I do think that she explained herself in a way that felt that seemed cathartic for her. I think that she also reminded people that she is a person of stature. One of the things that was so interesting to me as she was testifying was her posture, which I wrote about probably at great length, because I found it so fascinating that, so often, and Nathan Wade, I think, was an example of this when people are, testifying in a courtroom situation. Even, someone like Fani Willis, who is much more accustomed to asking the questions rather than having to answer them, there's a certain rigidity to the way that they're sitting. There's a, they're sort of sitting up and they're on high alert. And, there is a degree of nervousness, or at least trying to sort of put their best foot forward. And she was striking because she was sort of reclined in the chair. And at times, sort of had like one hand, against her, the side of her face, and she was looking skeptical. And I just thought that that posture reminded me of, sort of the term that we talk about with men, man spreading, where guys are like sitting on a bleacher and the legs are akimbo and they are taking up, practically three seats just because of the way that they're, because of their posture. And it felt like she was kind of doing the same thing, but she was sitting there in her fuchsia dress and, her, hair in curls and her strand of beads around her neck and sort of reveling in her womanliness and the power of that. And I thought, regardless of how you feel about what she did or didn't do, I thought that was just a really powerful statement about someone who is a woman, and it was sort of reveling in the power and authority of that.
I think a lot of people got that. I mean, I'm so glad you mentioned the man spread piece. I wanted to ask you about that, but I didn't want to bring it up, but I'm glad you did though, because that certainly got my attention. And oh, I will also say there are some pieces of this when I read, I had to laugh, even though it was not a comical thing, but the way in which you write, the way in which you present things just are, I mean, it's just such good writing. And I'm not going to try to sit here and keep heaping praise on you. This is all about,
Feel free.
this is all about this piece and all about the work that you did here.
Well, her little comment about Morgan State, that was.
You know, as a person who went to an HBCU, a Hampton grad, you know, that stuff happens all the time. And I was really thinking when I saw that, it's like, really? Did I just hear that on national TV? But it did. And okay. But there was a lot of drama here. Is there another shoe to drop? Because the way that this came out with her and Mr. Prosecutor Wade, I just kind of walked away from it. I was surprised first that all this was going on. But then I kind of wondered, wow, is this going to be something? Is there going to be something else here? I just want to know what your thoughts are about how this ended up in your eyes when you wrote it. Were you thinking this is it, or do you think there may be more?
I really don't, I don't know if there's going to be more, but as I was thinking about her decision and her, her words and her demeanor, I can't shake, the reality that, these are, we are, we, this hearing, we are in this place because of decisions that she made and that Mr. Wade made. And, whether or not you think that the hearing was overly invasive, or there should have even have been a hearing, that this is just, it's an affair that's blown out of proportion. The reality is that they made some decisions, and those decisions opened the door to our being in this place now. I thought that she went in and, with the goal of sort of getting things back on track, turning our attention back to the original issue at hand. And I think that, her outrage was sort of part of the fuel that was helping her to kind of push that rock up the hill. I don't know whether or not she'll be successful, but I certainly thought that in the process of trying to redirect our attention, I thought that she raised a lot of issues that have been at play during this case, and the way that people have dealt with her, engaged with her, and judged her.
Well, everyone, this is Robin Gavon, and she is an excellent writer. And I have been reading her columns since she was 3 years old, which probably I would say is about 30 years. And she has always been excellent. Robin, I'm going to just say this one thing. I've always wanted to say it, finally got the opportunity. You used to write columns about women's dress in the summer, how the appropriate nature of how women ought to dress in the summer. And I have never, ever forgotten just how blunt you have always been in those columns. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I have this feeling that it either has to do with sneakers or pantyhose.
Yes, the latter, the latter. And, it was so interesting to read those columns.
Can I just make it clear that I have always been on team no pantyhose?
Well, sure, you can make it. You can make it clear. Totally, totally understood. And hey, you can be on whichever side you want. But I just want to point out to folks that you write. I mean, when you write, you really write. And you write about things that matter to people. And you write about things a lot of people don't actually talk about. Things that people think about, but they may not say. But you do it well. We thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. And the last thing I'll ask you, are you working on anything now, a book, or is there some other special project, or are you just taking it easy and just doing one column a week now?
No, I had been on book leave for the last, I think it's been like 10 months, actually. So I just came back last week. So I've been very busy for 2 weeks.
All right. So I guess we'll be seeing a book from you pretty soon, right?
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, I hope you'll come back. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Stay tuned for some thoughts about race in America and details about our next guest.
You're listening to Colors.
My name is Debbie Ratliff. I am of Irish, Scottish, and Puerto Rican descent. I was born in Puerto Rico, raised in Maryland, and live in Virginia.
When I think about this, and I've said this a lot to friends and anyone who will listen to me, it's like we're all kind of reading from the same script, both people who are in favor of changing names and refocusing who we honor in this country and those who oppose it. The opposition we faced from our neighbors in Falls Church is the same opposition that people are facing today and that people faced before us. Our fight led by the students starting in 2015 is not the first. Other school names were changed long before we started our fight in 2015. And took a lot longer in some cases. Mm-hmm. But we were it got really hateful. It got really ugly. Where the, you know, kind of ad hominem attacks and wow. personal attacks to children who were, you know, the students who were testifying at school board meetings and afraid to testify. And, you know, it got really ugly. I mean, I received emails from people insulting me, you know, and you just don't expect another adult in your community to behave with such a degree of disrespect, to not be able to have a rational conversation. And that's what I kept trying to do, is just, let's just speak rationally. Let's try to listen to each other. Let's try to hear each other.
This is Colors, a dialogue on race in America.
If you have any questions or comments about Colors, send us an email. You can reach us at colors@thecolorspodcast.com. That's colors@thecolorspodcast.com.
Coming up in our next episode of Colors,
the Arab American National Museum.
This museum was created in 2005 in Dearborn, which is a heavily concentrated Arab American community.
Shava Najim is a community historian at the museum.
And it's for the purpose of representing the Arab American culture and community on a national level.
And she plays a very important role.
I basically collect oral histories from the community. So I work as an oral historian at the museum, and that's basically documenting the personal stories and narratives of Arab Americans.
She joins us with a very detailed look at this museum at a critical time in U.S. history. She also talks about her role as an oral historian and her background and family from Baghdad.
That's coming up in our next episode of Colors.
I really enjoyed that conversation today with Robin Givon, and as I promised, we're going to have some great episodes coming up. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks to Hillary Howard, Mike Jakaitis. Thanks to Deanna Howell at the Washington Post for helping us set this interview up today. Thanks to the Green family. Thanks to the Core family. Thanks to the Collins family. Thanks for our music to Jesse Gallagher, to Hanu Dijit, and to Akash Gandhi. Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for listening. And remember, just keep talking to each other.
And just as important, keep listening to each other.
You can subscribe to Colors wherever you get your podcasts. This is Colors, a dialogue on race in America.